From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Voters in Syria will cast ballots Wednesday to elect members of the next parliament. Press TV's Mohammed Ali reports from Damascus.
Syrians go to polling stations on Wednesday to elect new members of parliament. Over 7,000 electoral centers have been set up for voters to cast their ballots. Head of Syria's Higher Judicial Committee for Elections told Press TV that the country is all set for the vote.
The Higher Judicial Committee, along with subcommittees, has finished all preparations for the elections. We held a meeting and discussed possible obstacles and means to tackle them. We are fully prepared for the elections.
Over 3,500 candidates from all walks of life are competing for 250 seats in the People's Assembly in Syria. Some of them represent political parties, while others are independent. Firas hopes to win a seat to help Syrian youths resolve their problems.
It's important for youth to have representatives at parliament. They have suffered a lot from the current crisis. So I'm running in the elections to represent the youth. I focused on three problems in my campaign: housing, unemployment, and public transportation for the youth.
The candidates' electoral campaigns have focused on various ways to resolve economic problems. According to the general elections law, candidates have to stop campaigning 24 hours ahead of the voting.
Holding parliamentary elections in Syria after 5 years of a deadly war signals the Syrians' determination to decide their own future. It also shows that the Syrian government will not allow terrorist supporters to halt political life in Syria, and that it will continue facilitating a political solution along with fighting against terrorism. Hamad Ali, Press TV, Damascus.
But not everyone was enthusiastic about the elections set for Wednesday in Syria. This was State Department spokesperson Mark Toner on Monday at his daily press briefing.
We would view those elections as not legitimate in the sense that they don't represent the will of the Syrian people. There is talks in Geneva on a way to chart a political transition that we believe is the ultimate solution for the conflict in Syria. So to hold parliamentary elections now, given the current circumstances, given the current conditions in the country, we believe is at best premature and not representative of the Syrian people.
Those parliamentary elections are being held under the new constitution adopted in 2012 by a public referendum, which involved 57% of all Syrians in the world. About 90% of them voted yes, providing an absolute majority of all Syrians supporting the constitution. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that those countries directly involved in the South China Sea dispute should seek a common agreement, one which could be accepted by all sides. Lavrov also said other parties irrelevant to the core issues should avoid taking actions that increase tensions in the region. The Russian Foreign Minister made the remarks at a press conference kicking off a tour of Asia. Liu Kang, a spokesperson for China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, issued this statement in response.
We are pleased with the remarks made by Russia. Anyone, any organization, or any country who is concerned about the South China Sea issue should support a resolution through dialogue, should support China and relevant countries to negotiate according to international law and the declaration of the South China Sea. Any action trying to hype or exaggerate the conflict will not be constructive and will veer from the normal track.
Tuesday marks 55 years since Yuri Gagarin became the first human being in history to travel into outer space. To mark that 55th anniversary of the historic flight, Russia's space agency has set 2016 as the year of Yuri Gagarin. The April 12th anniversary has become an important one on the Russian calendar, and many Russians consider Gagarin to be a symbol of national glory. CCTV's Julia Lyubova reports from Moscow.
55 years ago, Yuri Gagarin was the first person to fly in space. He orbited the Earth once, then safely returned. His world-changing flight is celebrated every year in Russia on 12th of April. This year, Russia's heroes of space exploration are remembered and honored for their remarkable achievements. For most Russians, Yuri Gagarin's flight is a symbol of pride for their nation.
It was an event that raised us all above our heads. We could do it, we all could. That day was the fruit of the whole nation, the fruit of scientists, engineers, liberals, for all the people.
Gagarin was always a symbol of Russia, of mighty Russia, the Soviet Union before. He was the business card of our country.
More than half a century later, and global space programs have advanced, Yuri Gagarin's flight lasted less than 2 hours, while now cosmonauts spend nearly a year in space, living and working aboard the International Space Station. The 20th century marked the space race between the Soviet Union and the United States for supremacy in spaceflight capability, while these days different nations cooperate for advancements in space exploration. For example, Russia has several joint space projects with China.
Overall, there's a lot of cooperation in space between Russia and China. First of all, there's cooperation between our satellite navigation systems, Russia's GLONASS and China's Baidu. We're also discussing the development of various space rocket systems.
Later this year, China's new generation space launches, Long March 5 and Long March 7, will both make the debut flights. Space cooperation between Moscow and Beijing is in its early stages, but it may not be long before we see joint experiments on the ISS. Yuri Gagarin was the first man in space more than 5 decades ago, but with the latest innovations in the space industry around the world, over time, there may be many more space travelers.
Yuri Gagarin became an international star when his Vostok spacecraft completed an orbit of the Earth on 12th of April 1961. His 108-minute flight gave him a permanent place in the history books as the first man in space. To this day, this achievement is celebrated widely in Russia and abroad. Julia Lyubova, CCTV, Moscow.
Russia's space industry has made significant advances in recent years. Igor Komarov is the head of Roscosmos, the space agency of the Russian Federation. He was appointed to that position in January 2015 after serving as director of United Rocket Space Corporation, which was formed in 2013 by the Russian parliament to renationalize Russia's space program. He spoke with RT's Igor Piskunov about Russia's revived space program.
Mr. Komarov, thank you for your time. So, we have some ambitious space expeditions to look forward to in the next 55 years?
Hello. Yes, I think we're looking at a lot of progress to be made in the next 55 years, and a lot of exciting developments. That's a lot of time. I think that we will see a mission to Mars, and I think that Russia, together with its partners in other countries, will set up an orbital station on Mars. I'm sure there will also be a lot of research activity on the moon, including the creation of a lunar base and a lunar orbital station. By the way, we're already discussing such plans with our partners in NASA and the European Space Agency. The concept of a low-orbit space station, which today is the International Space Station, will also change significantly, assuming an entirely different set of functions, such as the servicing of spacecraft and space tugs, particularly for purposes of travelling to the Moon and to Mars. It will also serve other purposes, including, hopefully, space tourism.
Let's start with NASA. The agency stopped launching its own ships into space at some point, so getting astronauts to the ISS is now exclusively done by Russia. But NASA is planning to resume its own space launches. How much time do you think this might take?
Indeed, Russia is presently the only space power that flies cosmonauts and astronauts to the ISS. Things will stay this way for quite some time. NASA plans to resume its launches in 2019 with spacecraft produced by SpaceX, with the Lockheed Martin's Orion intended for flights to the ISS.
The US plans to end its dependency on Russian-made space engines. Is there an alternative to Russian hardware?
Well, let's be honest, they don't buy our engines out of charity. There's a simple and clear reason, and that is the fact that Russian-made engines are currently the best there are with regards to quality and price. And we're confident that things will stay this way for a few more years. We're open for cooperation. We've been supplying our engines to the United States, and we're looking at a number of opportunities this year for signing major contracts with other clients. As for competition, we're seeing serious activity in the United States aimed at upgrading their existing engines, but also developing new designs. For us, this is really an incentive to keep improving our performance and design new engines rather than rest on our laurels.
Who would you name as Russia's real competitors in the area of space exploration, if any?
There certainly are. There are areas where Russia is an undisputed leader, particularly launch vehicles and launch services. This is where we're number one by a large margin, administering about 40% of all space launches worldwide. We're also number one in the engine market, which you have already mentioned, and in the area of manned space programs. But in other areas, we've got room for improvement, and we could certainly learn a thing or two from our competitors in areas such as spacecraft quality, communications, or Earth remote sensing systems.
You've mentioned flying to Mars. There's a joint project called ExoMars, which looks pretty promising. What is Russia expecting from it? There have been many attempts to fly to Mars in the past, with little success. What makes this project likely to succeed?
A successful start, I'd say. In fact, Roscosmos and Russian companies were the ones in charge of some of this project's most critical phases, namely the launch and orbit insertion for heading to Mars. And we did well. Our Proton-M launch vehicle and booster managed to deliver the orbiter precisely according to its planned flight path. In contrast to some of the earlier setbacks, this one went trouble-free. We find that pretty encouraging. Next, we're expecting a mid-course maneuver to adjust trajectory in July, and we're confident that around October 16th, a joint mission with the European Space Agency will be able to reach Mars, orbit it, and go operational. The scientists from many nations who have spent the last 10 or 12 years working on this project are certainly looking forward to that, hoping for some profound results.
Let's talk a little bit about the United States. Moscow and Washington may have their political disputes, but Russian cosmonauts and American astronauts seem to get along just fine on board the ISS, from what we see on social media. Do you think their friendship will endure during these troubled times?
I believe it already has. Last year, it was the 40th anniversary of the Soyuz Apollo project, and we had a big celebration for this milestone event. And there I saw Tom Stafford and Alexei Leonov address the audience and share their memories. The level of cooperation and the spirit of collaboration this mission managed to achieve against the background of the Cold War and the highly strained relations between the then Soviet Union and the United States is truly remarkable. We also had NASA Administrator Charles Bolden visit Russia for an evaluation of the recently completed ISS year-long mission. And I saw him talk to the cosmonauts and to Sergei Krikalev, with whom he had spent so much time together on board the space station, as well as training and preparing for the mission. And I've seen the relations between Mikhail Kornienko and Scott Kelly after they'd spent a year together at the ISS. And I'm sure this spirit and this relationship will live on. This is a sentiment I've seen from cosmonauts who've participated in joint missions, as well as from those who've trained together. And I would say that both space agencies, namely Roscosmos and NASA, also share this attitude. You see, looking from outer space, you don't see any borders on Earth. And there's an understanding that all our political differences and rivalries is something we should leave down there, rather than drag it with us into outer space. Space is a realm we can only explore through joint effort. Therefore, we must preserve the relationship we have now.
Do you think private financing will become more significant in the future?
We're seeing that many governments are showing a lot of interest in encouraging private entrepreneurship in space, and we're also supportive of that. We believe private companies have an important role to play in a number of areas related to the production and operation of spacecraft, communications and ERS services, etc. It's already a reality, and we should certainly support that. We're seeing some impressive initiatives in the area of launch vehicle production, new companies emerging and giving the market a serious shake-up and giving it a new impetus for improving performance and efficiency. However, in areas such as deep space exploration or fundamental scientific research, we probably shouldn't expect a serious breakthrough from a private investor. That kind of exploration requires the investment of enormous resources, while benefiting science and humanity as such, rather than any private stakeholder. I don't expect this kind of research to become profitable in our lifetime or anytime soon. Therefore, government support and government programs for space exploration will remain essential, and we see Russia and other nations to continue to provide that.
Presently, all Russian missions are launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome that Kazakhstan leases to Russia. But at the same time, Vostochny launching facility has been under construction in Russia. When can we expect the first launch from there, and what about the first manned flight?
Indeed, one of the key and most important projects, not only for the Russian space industry, but for Russia in general, is the construction of the Vostochny Cosmodrome. We're actively working on preparing the first launch from this facility, sending to space our legendary Soyuz launch vehicle. We plan for it to happen by the end of April. We have ambitious plans to develop this cosmodrome, and I think with it lies our future.
Let's get back to Mars, which is truly a topic of interest. The flight to Mars takes approximately 6 months. Will it be possible to get there faster by introducing new engines or new technologies?
You're right. Reducing the flight time is one of the tasks we try to tackle. Unfortunately, with existing technologies and engines, the journey to Mars takes about 6 months. There's another reason to develop and improve technologies to make the journey shorter. The space environment is pretty aggressive. It contains high levels of radiation. So reducing the travel time is also important in terms of ensuring that the human body functions properly. If we want to explore faraway planets, engine construction should be given a new boost to make engines perform more efficiently and cut down the time it takes for spacecraft to travel between different orbits.
The first flight to space 55 years ago was of huge importance to everybody on our planet. But since then, space missions have become a common occurrence. Has space exploration lost its initial romantic air?
I think that all the cosmonauts and astronauts who have been to space, those who have recently returned or plan to go to orbit, and everybody involved in preparation of space flights would definitely answer no to your question. It can never become routine, and it has not become routine to this day. As the head of Roscosmos, I'm personally involved with all the launches of manned missions to the ISS, and I can tell you that it is a huge responsibility and an extremely complex process that requires an enormous amount of preparation and training and a great deal of dedication from the crew about to go to space and the people instrumental in making it happen. So I do not see it turning into something routine, maybe in a distant future.
Do children still dream of becoming cosmonauts?
Yes, they do. In my line of work, I've learned that many children are happy about the progress we achieve and want to become cosmonauts. It's kind of like setting a challenge for yourself and paving your way to the future.
Let's go back to the ISS for a bit. It really is an example of many countries cooperating successfully. How do you envisage the future of the ISS in, say, 10 to 15 years?
I think that in 10 to 15 years, the ISS will have undergone significant changes. New goals are being set, so a new set of functions will be needed to accomplish them. Of course, many modules will remain and we'll keep conducting certain experiments. For example, the experiments to determine the effects of zero gravity on the human body. But I believe many things will change due to technological advancements, and the new functions of the ISS will have to fulfill, which I hope will include the servicing of spacecraft in orbit, servicing and assembling into-orbit spacecraft from the modules delivered from the ground, and maybe repairing space tugs that I think will be developed in the future. If there's demand, then maybe new segments will be introduced specifically for space tourists.
There are high hopes for the heavy-lift Angara space launch vehicle, and I understand this will be the rocket to deliver the spacecraft to the Moon and to Mars. What stage of development is it currently at?
By the end of February, we drew up the preliminary design of a heavy-lift rocket, Angara A5V, which looks really promising. It's now being reviewed by all the relevant research institutes and key organizations in our industry. In the near future, in the next 2 weeks, the Roscosmos board will look at the results, and then we'll start working hard on it to fulfill our promise. That is to launch the Angara A5 rocket from the new Cosmodrome by the end of 2021, and a manned mission launched by the end of 2023. We have to complete preparations for lunar missions and A5V by 2025.
Do you watch films about space exploration? How much do they resemble real life?
A fair bit. People who work in the space industry and space programs can naturally find plenty of flaws and gaps in research, but I think we shouldn't be so nitpicky, because the main thing about those films are the feelings, the ideas, the philosophy and the plot. I believe the most important thing is that a great number of people find them interesting. Sci-fi films certainly differ a lot from what experts deal with in real life, but I'd say that if we compare them to the films made 20 or 30 years ago, there's as much of a difference there as with the technological progress, that is to say, an enormous one. This genre will be developing along with technology, and we can only support that.
What would you like to say to your viewers on this big day?
I would say that they should remember our achievements and proudly look to the future, because the future holds a lot of exciting projects and new achievements when it comes to exploring the Moon and Mars, building new space stations and conducting new experiments. I think new achievements, just as great as those recorded in our history and that of Yuri Gagarin, lie ahead, and I believe that this is only the beginning.
China has also been busily growing its presence in space. Advancing China's space program is a priority for Beijing, with President Xi Jinping calling for the country to establish itself as a space power. This was Li Xian, Deputy Director of the Beijing Aerospace Command and Control Center, speaking with CCTV about China's extraterrestrial efforts this year.
We have never carried out such intensive space missions like this year, which has posed new challenges for us. The Tiangong 2 space lab will be sent into a new orbit that is higher than any of those sent before. To ensure the success of the mission, we have to adjust all data of the fire control system.
China confirmed it will send its second orbital space lab later this year as part of the nation's plan to have a permanent manned space station in service before 2022. The second space lab, Tiangong, or Heavenly Palace 2, is expected to dock with the country's first cargo ship, Tianzhou 1, the Heavenly Vessel, which was scheduled to be launched in the first half of next year. China also plans to launch the Zhenhua 11 spacecraft, which would carry two astronauts on board, in the fourth quarter of this year, to dock with Tiangong 2. After its first test flight in the Wenchang Satellite Launch Center in Hainan Province, a next-generation Long March 7 rocket will put Tianzhou 1 into space. That mission will carry out experiments to help test key technologies, including cargo transportation, the resupply of propellant for orbiting, and the medium-term stay of astronauts, as well as conducting relatively large-scale space science and application experiments. The peculiar relationship between the Democratic Party and some members of the Black Lives Matter movement has some tongues wagging, but what's missing is a look behind what the government is really doing with respect to actual Black Lives Matter activists. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
The U.S. corporate media would have you believe that the movement that goes under the heading of Black Lives Matter has already gained substantial acceptance in the ruling circles of the United States, especially on the Democratic side of the electoral duopoly. That progress is evident in Hillary Clinton's acceptance of the fact of her own white privilege and the Democratic National Committee's endorsement of the Black Lives Matter Network's founders by name, and that the movement is now transitioning into the mainstream with Twitterist DeRay McKesson's campaign for mayor of Baltimore. The reality is that the U.S. national security and mass black incarceration state is intent on breaking the back of the movement through the usual means, police repression, reinforced by more recent innovations in the technology of political control. And just as with the Occupy movement of a few years ago, the task of containing and neutralizing the movement will fall to democratic administrations in the nation's big cities, cities like Los Angeles. L.A. is the center of the criminal injustice system's counteroffensive. A batch of six Black Lives Matter protesters face possible retrial this month after a jury failed to convict them on misdemeanor charges for barricading an L.A. highway in November of 2014. The trial of three more protesters is underway for taking part in a 1,000-person-strong demonstration in which a commuter train was stopped in April of 2015. Mayor Eric Garcetti and his city attorneys seem determined to take down the movement's best cadres, selectively prosecuting only 20 of the 330 people arrested in the 2014 protests, all of them active members of Black Lives Matter. In an interview on Democracy Now!, Black Lives Matter lawyer Nana Gyamfi said officers of a secret police cyber unit have been taking pictures of activists, collecting names, and then matching them up with postings on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media. Clearly, the cops are forming maps of activist social networks and gathering evidence for conspiracy charges in the future. According to Gyamfi, letters on LAPD stationery have been sent to activists' workplaces, informing their bosses that they've been arrested for felony conspiracy to commit a crime. Sounds like COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program to disrupt and neutralize radical organizations, two generations ago. COINTELPRO also coexisted with Democratic Party attempts to co-opt black movement leadership. At the same time that Dr. Martin Luther King was making visits to the White House, the Kennedy brothers and later President Lyndon Johnson were authorizing the FBI to spy on his activities. They sent letters urging King to kill himself, and we all know how that turned out. Los Angeles was the city where SWAT teams were first deployed in 1969 against the headquarters of the Black Panther Party. It looks like L.A. will be the point of the spear for political police repression in the 21st century. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And we close with this memorial from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A soldier passes, Abu-Majid.
Political prisoner here in the state of New York, and I just want to give a shout out to brothers and sisters that are locked down, and particularly Jamil Alamein, Matula Shakur, Sekou Odinga, brothers out there on the West Coast, Rochelle McGee, Chip, Hugo, Brother Lenny Patel, brothers stay strong, and keep Sister Asada Shakur free by any means necessary. All power to the people, assalamu alaikum.
His name was Abdul Majid, and in his youth, he soldiered for the Black Panther Party in New York. When he was arrested in 1982, he was beaten badly and charged in the April 1981 shootout with a cop. He and his colleague, Black Panther Bashir Hamid, were tried three times before a conviction was returned. They were known as the Queens Two, black revolutionary political prisoners of the state. Although it took three juries to return guilty pleas, the men continued to struggle against their imprisonment. That final jury, by the way, was obtained by the exclusion of black jurors from the panel. Abdul Majid was known during his radical youth as an organizer for the Ocean Hill Brownsville Tenants Association in Brooklyn, New York, working for the people. Abdul Majid, after 33 plus years in a prison cell, has returned to his fathers. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.